With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And I wanted to return today to a topic that I've focused on before, India at the start of the Second World War, and the effect that the declaration of war had on Indian politics, principally between three actors, the Viceroy, the Congress Party of Jawaharlal Nehru and Gandhi, and the Muslim League of Muhammad Ali Jinnah. Previously, we'd seen how Lord Linlithgow, the Viceroy, had declared war unilaterally on India's behalf in September 1939. India, as not yet a dominion of the British Empire, but a sufficiently large colony with a sufficiently advanced and quite rebellious political class, was a country that it was very difficult to make these sorts of unilateral declarations. Obviously, other dominions like Canada and Australia and New Zealand were able to decide for themselves whether they wished to join the Second World War, though it was almost inconceivable that they wouldn't join on Britain's side. India was a different proposition altogether. The declaration of war was greeted by outrage from the Congress Party. The Congress Party was secular. It was a party that represented or hoped to represent all of India, Muslim, Hindu, Jain, Sikh and other other groups. And also a party which, with Gandhi's influence and also Nehru's, tried to represent the poor of India to varying degrees of success. Gandhi, with a kind of a rather rural Tolstoyan idea of self-sufficiency at a very small local level, and Nehru, a far more statist, socialist leader, who in the 1950s would become very much more sympathetic to the Soviet Union and was devastated, immensely disappointed by war which follows with China. By October 1939, the Congress Party was waiting eagerly for an official statement from Linlithgow, one which would hopefully give clear war aims and limits as to how and where Indian soldiers would be deployed, and also an indication of the payoff at the end of the war. Congress believed that the only possible inducement to Indians to fight would be full independence. Obviously, Linlithgow wasn't going to offer that. On the 17th of October, he gives a very generalised set of blandishments. This is not being promised before. This says everything and nothing, really. And the response from the Congress is harsh. "Congress asked for bread," said Gandhi, "and it has got stone." Nehru referred to it as a complete repudiation of all that India stands for nationally and internationally. It has absolutely no relation to reality. This was what Linlithgow had said. And the threat from the Congress was to resign unilaterally and to refuse to give any support to Great Britain. This is the Congress party. This, the British knew, would be a diplomatic defeat for them. It would look very bad with America and other neutral countries, and it would look very bad across the rest of the empire, and it would also hand a free goal to Britain's enemies. And and it would also bolster the idea that the British Empire was fraying at the seams and was extremely weak, which wasn't wide of the mark. So the plan that the British suggested was to allow onto the Executive Council, the Viceroy's Executive Council, more Indian Congress politicians, and the three key portfolios that were going to be offered initially were finance, home affairs and defence, so the most significant ones. Chamberlain thought this was no bad idea. Neville Chamberlain was, of course, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, and he thought that if Indians were going to be dragged into a war which they had not bargained for or asked for, the least that Britain could offer them was some kind of say in the running of their own country. Churchill, in characteristic style, was opposed to the defence portfolio being handed over to Indian politicians, and he also opposed any kind of concession, believing that it would only encourage and be dangerous because it would encourage Congress to demand more. The compromise position that Churchill eventually comes to is that if Britain retains control over military and strategy, if Britain is able to prevent any change to the constitution for the duration of the war, and if Britain is able to ensure that the Viceroy's supremacy is not challenged, then sure, allow some Indian politicians into the cabinet, the executive committee. The view that Churchill has of India has long been kind of a real stain on his reputation, one of several, and this reaches its kind of apogee in 1943 with the Bengal famine and the kind of openly racist statements he makes about Bengalis and Indians in general, and his decisions about the allocation of foodstuffs, which have catastrophic consequences for Bengal. Even though the cabinet eventually agreed to these concessions and they authorised the Viceroy to start making the necessary negotiations with the Congress, they didn't bank on Jinnah's Muslim League and the objections that the Muslim League would have to bringing the essentially Congress politicians. I don't think there was any indication that any Muslim politicians would be invited on to the executive committee. The Muslim League would have significant objections to Congress politicians participating. And it was here that the outbreak of war began to spark deeper political conflicts, which had already kind of on the boil in India, and started to bring these to crisis point. The question of whether or not all of India would get behind Britain's war was a moot one, and it was a moot one because India, with the prospect of independence or some kind of dominion status in the future, was divided as to what that would look like, and therefore the possibilities that war presented were not lost on either side, Congress or Muslim League, and therefore the decision to take India to war were to be based on specific criteria and requirements. What would India and what would subsections of Indian society get out of this war? These were the questions that were being asked. And Jinnah looked warily at the Congress party and thought, well, this is really, in his eyes, a Hindu party. Arguably it wasn't, but in his eyes, this is a Hindu party taking us to war, and Jinnah himself wasn't necessarily opposed to war. Jinnah knew that the British in many ways were more favourable to the Muslim League and looked upon the Muslim League as being far more useful than the Congress. The British government had wrapped themselves up in a degree of unwarranted optimism about India, the belief that Indian peasants would somehow benefit from the industrial activity of the war, that Indians would declare themselves loyal to the crown, that Indians would look upon events in Europe with the same degree of intensity and interest that the British did. All of these things were pretty thin aspirations, though the British clung to them, the British war cabinet at any rate. The British cabinet considered a proposal that India be given independence immediately after the war. And here is where the real kind of conflict with the Muslim League emerges. So if India was to be given independence after the war, a kind of an unconditional promise by the British, then it would be the nature of that independence that would come under scrutiny from both sides. If it was independence on the Congress party's terms, then Jinnah feared that Muslims in India would either become a second-class citizenry, or there would indeed be immense violence towards them. And so separatism it becomes a much more key issue at this point. The British eventually veto any idea about offering India independence. Not because the British government didn't think it was probably on the cards, but because they thought that any hard and fast statement was going to produce conflict. And so endless kind of fudge, if you will, was going to be the official policy throughout the war years. Of course, the Muslim League would automatically have vetoed opposed any initiative to simply hand India a carte blanche independence. Lord Linlithgow essentially says that any constitutional development has to be based on an agreement between Congress and whichever body speaks for India's Muslims, of which the Muslim League clearly was able to claim that title. And therefore, it gave the Muslim League an effective veto on any kind of constitutional change during the war. The Congress suggested or proposed a constituent assembly that would be elected after independence that would feature all Indians or representatives of all Indians irrespective of religion, and the version of this suggested by Gandhi is in fact even more radical. He said that there should be an adulterated adult franchise for men and women. He said, illiteracy does not worry me.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen,
premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
And he said that this would allow the Harryans, the Untouchables, to be involved in politics and to have the franchise, and this would in itself bring about some kind of social revolution in post-independence India. In November 1939, the Congress Working Committee said that the proposed assembly would be elected on adult suffrage. This would mean that minorities, religious minorities, would be represented by members elected by separate electorates, and their rights in constitutions, in the constitution, would be protected to their satisfaction. Any details that could not be settled by negotiations would be submitted to arbitration, so there would be some kind of Supreme Court that would look at things on a case-by-case basis. Gandhi, Jinnah and Nehru met, and Gandhi and Nehru attempted to offer Jinnah assurances that the Muslim League would have representation, and that there would be protection for the rights and interests of Muslims in India when the British left. And there was the possibility that some kind of understanding might be reached. There were definite hopes between the British government and the Viceroy Lynn Lithgow that some kind of compromise was possible, and this would have quickly presented a united war government in India. Jinnah was suspicious, however. He saw any settlement in which Muslims were referred to as a minority as something that wasn't worth the paper it was written on, and that there would be all sorts of backtracking and loopholes that would mean that their interests would not be protected. And he referred to the assembly that was being planned as a packed body manoeuvred and managed by the Congress caucus, and said that Gandhi had not been taking the issue of Muslim-Hindu affairs seriously and needed to apply himself to it with greater rigour. And by December, the Muslim League had declared that the Congress government had ceased to function and couldn't function without them. Linlithgow, at the end of the year, said that the political quarrel, as he'd seen it, had entered into a new phase. He said it was remarkable how peaceful the country was on reflection. And he wrote to the government, "In spite of the political crisis, India has not wavered in denunciation of the enemy in Europe and has not failed to render all help needed in the prosecution of the war. The men required as recruits for the army are forthcoming. Assistance in money from princes and others continues to be offered. A great extension of India's effort in the field of supply is proceeding apace." And in January 1940, Linlithgow went as far as offering dominion status to India as soon as was practically possible after the war. He spoke to an audience in Bombay, stating that The political situation in India, which was always a problem as far as he was concerned, was one of minorities. There were no easy solutions, and the claims of minorities, especially he referred to the Muslims and the depressed classes, had to be safeguarded. So he understood well enough what hurdles were necessary to overcome. The only problem was that as far as Jinnah was concerned, there was virtually nothing that could safeguard the interests of Muslims. Linlithgow had an ulterior motive in the speech, however. In the winter of 1939 to 1940, the Soviet Union had invaded Finland and had fought the Winter War and been rather badly mauled by the Finns in the process. However, during this period of time, the Soviet Union, which had a non-aggression pact with Hitler, one which, as far as the British and the French were concerned, could blossom into a full alliance at some point in the near future, the Soviet Union was a potential enemy, and it was being considered by the British whether the Soviet Union might in fact be a good prospect for attack. Possibly in Finland and also possibly in the Caucasus. And this would have huge implications for India, the renewal of Anglo-Russian tensions that had existed in the period in the region from Persia to Afghanistan in the late 19th century would be renewed with a vengeance, with instead of fighting the Tsar's Russia, fighting Stalin's Soviet Union. On reflection, it's probably for the best, as far as the British are concerned and the French, that they didn't decide to take on the Soviets in this way, given their almost inexhaustible manpower that finally defeats the Third Reich. However, by giving dominion status and a generally rather breezy and optimistic view of India and the war, two gathered Indian and British dignitaries in Bombay in January 1940. Lord Linlithgow was able to offer significant concessions to the Indian ruling class with the possibility that they might be in a war far closer to India's borders than they had ever bargained for. The British had imagined that probably a Soviet land invasion of Afghanistan wouldn't happen. But as with all powers in the 1930s, the obsession with bombing had not escaped their attention, and the possibility that the Soviets might bomb Indian cities was present in the minds of the chiefs of the Imperial General Staff. And at that point, a terrible and paradoxical situation might exist for Britain. India, with a general shortage of manpower in 1939-1940, might call upon the mother country to divert troops from Europe to defend India. So British calculations about India and the Second World War were based on an understanding of imperial overstretch and the multiplicity of threats that surrounded the British Empire. Previously in the 19th century, one had to consider France and Russia, but almost never at the same time. There is a brief and sort of fairly aberrant period of the 1890s up until 1918, where the key problem that Britain faces is Germany. But by the 1930s, a fascist Italy, fascist Germany, fascist Japan and the Soviet Union present between them an existential threat to the continuance of the British Empire. There were voices within Britain's war cabinet suggesting that dominion status should be fast-tracked for India. Linlithgow isn't quite as enthusiastic, despite what he says in his speeches, stressing that, yes, this is probably the best policy to take, but one should go very slowly in India. And in his typical kind of colonial, slightly sort of patronising standpoint, he believed that the Indian Congress Party was not yet strong enough. He said their shoulders are not yet broad enough to take upon the burden of government. And the experience of the last few months has suggested that India's contribution to the war hadn't really changed very much. So, as he said previously, that troops were, men were enlisting and money was being raised, so we didn't have to worry that much about India. The only particular problem, of course, for Linlithgow was that if India did come under attack, then it would present an immense political crisis, and more would have to be offered very quickly in order to keep India fighting, and to keep India fighting particularly not just for itself, but for the British Empire. Churchill was with Linlithgow and said basically that when Congress resigned, it was a bluff and it didn't work, and the Indian population simply stood by the Viceroy's government, and this is all kind of part of Churchill's worldview anyway. He said, India enjoyed a period of perfect tranquility, and he suggested that don't waste your time trying to promote unity between Hindus and Muslims. And he said, such unity was in fact almost out of the realm of practical politics. Well, if it were to be brought about, the immediate result would be that the united communities would join in showing us the door, which probably would be the case. And he said, interestingly for our purposes, that the Hindu-Muslim problem was a bulwark of British rule in India. So the British have often been accused of divide and rule, and Churchill here pretty much confirms that that is indeed how things work. Okay, well, I hope you've enjoyed this and found this useful, and we'll be looking more at India and the Second World War soon. And if you can support us on Patreon, there is some original journalism and history writing that I'm sticking up there at the moment. Do check it out. It's all good stuff. And I'll put the link at the end of the podcast in the link a bit. All the best. I'll catch you on the next Explaining History podcast. Bye-bye.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.